Considering how many people are not feeling great today, I take this as a significant sign of interest in counterfeit gospels that you are here and you're interested in this topic and this class. So welcome to Counterfeit Gospels. What we're going to do today is an introductory lesson. So I want to overview where we're heading, how we're going to do it, and really talk through kind of the why of this class. So this is introduction, overview, and the why. So I gave you a handout that is how the schedule stands for now. As always, when we talk about the future, we talk about Lord willing. This is the plan, so there could be some adjustments. But today, our introduction, and then our plan is for most of these cults or false religions to give 2 weeks to each one, although some only have one. So following this, 2 weeks on Jehovah's, I always put it in Jehovah's false witnesses, but Jehovah's Witnesses. We have our once a month men's and women's Sunday school class, so that's marked on here on the schedule. 2 weeks on Mormonism, 2 weeks on Islam that will be broken up by another men's and women's time, 2 weeks on Roman Catholicism, and then men's and women's, as well as a prayer Sunday school, and then 2 weeks on New Age spirituality, which kind of ends up covering a lot of different concepts and ideas, a little harder to pin down New Age spirituality, unlike a codified religion like Jehovah's Witness and Mormonism. And then, Lord willing, we'll end with a Q&A. All right, so that's what we're hoping to cover. That's what we're hoping to do. Devin and I will be sharing, teaching throughout these. It's 12 teaching weeks is what it ends up being, if the Lord wills. Okay? So let's talk today about why counterfeit gospels. Why are we doing this class, and even why are we calling it counterfeit gospels? The idea of counterfeit should be a pretty straightforward comparison and idea, because we're all familiar with the idea of things like counterfeit money. I don't know how many of you play, maybe even over the Christmas and New Year's break, some of you played that awful game as a family called Monopoly. Got any Monopoly people in here? Oh, all right, you all agree with my parents, which said, we will never play this game. It takes forever, and inevitably, some family member is really, really mad at some other family member for stealing their, you know, boardwalk or taking all their money. But you got Monopoly money, and the thing about Monopoly money is, and if you love Monopoly, that's perfectly fine. Like, we love family games, so you can have Monopoly. But the point is, Monopoly money doesn't look like real money. Only to a tiny little kid does that look like real money. Monopoly money is very obviously Monopoly money. It's different size, it's different color, like it's just Monopoly money. And when it comes to something like Monopoly money, nobody is confused by Monopoly money being a counterfeit. But when it comes to something that gets closer and closer to the real thing, that's when we start to struggle. A good counterfeit doesn't look wildly different than the real thing, it tries to mirror it. When we talk about a variety of cults and false religions, there is the more they counterfeit the real thing, that when they can say something that's relatively close, when they can steal, for instance, language that is our language or Bible language, when you can steal a word like faith and redefine it, when you take a person like Jesus and then just skew what the Bible says about him and come up with a few things that are different, now you have a more effective counterfeit. Right, a good counterfeit doesn't look wildly different than the real thing. It takes, it borrows, it steals, and then it twists the real thing. All right. Back in 2003, which has been long enough now that I've almost like become accustomed to it, but back in 2003, the U.S. government redesigned the $20 bill. I don't know if you remember the old $20 bill or how many you have. I don't know how many $20 bills you have. I haven't have one in my wallet today because of this introduction. So this is the redesigned $20 bill, which now has become, I don't know, like my eyes have become accustomed to it. I still remember when this $20 bill first came out, and I thought it was the weirdest thing I had seen, because money had looked the same for so very long. So what were some of the redesigned things on the $20 bill? And they started doing this with other bills too, bills that I don't happen to have in my wallet, like $100 bills and other things. They started changing them. right? So for instance, you had things like color shifting ink. So the 20 down in the corner here, it shifts from kind of copper to green when you tilt it in the light. All right, that was a redesigned safety feature. It's got a watermark on it. So if you hold it just the right way, there's actually two Jacksons on this bill. There's the very obvious one, and there's like the watermark one behind him. There's security thread. It's actually a thread that runs vertical through the new $20 bill, and it's embedded in the paper. There are new sizes, so like the 20 became a lot bigger on the back. There used to be an oval that was printed around Andrew Jackson's head. They removed that oval and they shifted the whole image up. So instead of it just being like his face, his like shoulders became a part of it. The amount of effort, the technology, the money that was spent making this bill was enormous. Of course, lots of things our government does, it takes an exorbitant amount of money, but that's besides the point. The point is a lot of time, effort, and money went into redesigning the $20 bill. What was the reason for that? Well, because counterfeiting cost the U.S. government significant fortune because of how counterfeits affect the market, how they affect the security of our money. Counterfeits can wreck an economy. And so they spent all this technology, time, and effort redesigning this because they're trying to combat counterfeits. All right? The idea of counterfeits and what they've done with this $20 bill is they've tried to make it, it's impossible to completely get rid of counterfeits, but they've tried to make it so that it's so hard to counterfeit the $20 bill that people will just stop trying. And basically say, we're not gonna be able to create an effective counterfeit $20 bill, so we're not even gonna try to mirror all of the things. We're just gonna try to get by with people that don't know any better. So now the effective counterfeit, it's not that you're gonna pass a counterfeit at a bank or at anywhere that handles money on a regular basis because it's become so difficult. But people that don't know any better, now that's where counterfeiters are able to move money, right? And I think the same thing is true religiously. People want to take and steal and imitate the true gospel, and those that are most susceptible to it are people that are unaware and uninformed, and they're susceptible. I think these are compelling reasons. I hope these are compelling reasons for you as we say, why counterfeit gospels? What are some reasons that we need this class? And so I've listed them for you on your paper. So here they are. And the first is an argument from Galatians 1, 6 to 9. So if you have your Bible, you can open up there because we'll actually spend the bulk of our time in Galatians 1, 6 to 9. And again, all of this as an attempt, as an introduction to setting up this class. Here's Galatians 1, 6 to 9. I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. Not that there is another one, but there are some who trouble you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. But even if we, or an angel from heaven, should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one we preach to you, let him be accursed. As we have said before, so now I say again, if anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed. Some reasons that we should have this class and we should consider counterfeit gospels is that the gospel is something that can be abandoned. If we're not thinking about the true gospel, then the gospel is something that you and I can walk away from. The gospel is something that can be abandoned. Notice in verse number 6, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. It's language of abandonment. It's changing sides. And Paul tells the Galatians he's astonished that they are abandoning the gospel. You've switched in that classic family movie Cars. There are these twin car fans, and they're big fans of Lightning McQueen, and so they wear like Lightning McQueen colors. And then as soon as Lightning McQueen disappears off the scene, they switch to his rival. And the very next scene, those same twin cars are then painted in the colors of Chick Hicks, the evil, terrible bad guy in Cars, right? But the point is you have these fans, and as soon as Lightning McQueen disappears, boom, they switch sides, right? They just abandon them. Now, that's just a silly movie. And same could be true about other people that just abandon their sports teams, right? Like their team goes through a hard time and then all of a sudden, man, we just forget that team. I'm going to pick a new team. Not a big deal when we're talking about sports. It is a big deal when we talk about the gospel being something that people walk away from. And Paul says he is astonished. And this word astonished, it's a strong word. We can trace this word through our New Testament. In Matthew 8:10, Jesus was astonished at the centurion that had enough faith to ask Jesus to heal from a distance. It says Jesus was astonished at that. In Matthew 8:27, the disciples were astonished that the winds and the waves obeyed Jesus when he said, "Peace, be still." That's this word, astonished. This is shocking. This is like, I can't believe that just happened. Like, this is amazing. Wow. Matthew 9:33, the crowds were astonished that Jesus cast a demon out of a mute man who could then talk again. That's this word, astonished. It's a strong word. Pilate was astonished when Jesus didn't say a word to his accusers. In Acts 2, the account of Pentecost, the crowd was astonished when they heard the disciples speaking in their languages. In Acts 7:31, we find out that Moses was astonished by the burning bush. Remember the account, Moses is walking through and he sees a bush that's burning and it's not burnt up, it's not consumed, and he's astonished. It's the same word. Paul says, I'm astonished that you're abandoning the gospel. You're deserting him who called you and you're turning to a different gospel. The gospel is something that can be abandoned. This is when you hear or see something and you can hardly believe it. It amazes you. It's been pointed out before, and probably you know this about Galatians. There's no Thanksgiving section in Galatians. When Paul says, I am astonished that you are turning to a different gospel, he has just said hello, grace and peace to you. He's praised God, and then unlike all the other letters where there is a note of thanksgiving, Paul goes straight to, I am shocked. He doesn't say, I'm grateful, I'm thankful, here's what God's doing in your life. He just goes straight to, I'm shocked. Paul even managed to find things to praise the Corinthian church about. And if you know what's happening to the church in Corinth, you had massive problems. And he even managed to say he was thankful for them in some ways. The Galatians, he just goes straight to, I'm shocked. The situation is dire. There's no thanks. He's clearly intending a rebuke when he says, I am astonished. His astonishment ought to make the Galatians ashamed that they are abandoning the gospel. And they're not just abandoning it, but it's, notice, you're so quickly doing it. I am astonished you are so quickly deserting. If we're right about when Galatians was written, we think that Paul evangelized the Galatians around 47 AD. And we think that the letter got written either around 49 AD or 52 AD. So we're talking 2 years, probably at the most 4 years, that they have deserted, they have started to walk away from the gospel. And he is astonished that this has happened, and it's happened so quickly. And you say, well, good thing it's just the Galatians, and nobody else would ever do that. We certainly wouldn't, and there wouldn't be any other place in our Bibles where we see this kind of thing, would we? And then we remember Exodus 32, verse number 8. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They have made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And then we remember that it took the Israelites only until Moses went up on Mount Sinai. They had literally seen the 10 plagues in Egypt. They had escaped from Egypt. They went across the Red Sea. They had gone to Mount Sinai. And in that period of time, they so quickly deserted him. All right. So we ought to be able to look at Galatians as warning enough, but we certainly can go all the way back to the Israelites and go, well, who are we to think that we would never quickly desert him who called us? Who are we to think that we would never walk away from the gospel? Why we need classes like counterfeit gospels is the gospel is something that can be abandoned. And it is just as true for you and for me as it was for the Galatians and it was for the Israelites back in the Exodus from Egypt. In some ways, the Israelites exiting Egypt, they got to see these massive displays of power from the one true God, and the awfulness of their idolatry is, these are your gods who delivered you from Egypt, right? So if we walk away from the gospel, we're walking to different gods. That's our second point that I think Paul's making, a second reason for us to care about counterfeit gospels. If you abandon the gospel, you're actually abandoning God. This is also represented in the Israelites, Judges 2:17. They did not listen to their judges, for they whored after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord, and they did not do so. But if you abandon the gospel, you abandon God. Notice he says, I'm astonished that you're so quickly deserting. And he starts with what? You're so quickly deserting him. Starts with a person. Walking away from the gospel means walking away from God. If you abandon the gospel, you abandon God. He says, you're so quickly deserting him who called you. That word deserting, in Greek philosophy, this would be somebody that leaves one school of thought for another. In military terms, we're probably more familiar with that, this is the deserter. Somebody that leaves their post, that turns traitor, that runs away. They're still, even in modern military terms, a deserter is still that's a despicable term. That's a person who's punished severely and strongly. Maybe not as strongly as in the past. In the past, there were times when deserters would just be shot, right? Like, you desert, now you're dead, right? Paul's using this kind of language. He says, you're deserting him, you're abandoning him. When he says, you are quickly deserting, he's describing something that they are in the act of. You're in the process of desertion. It's not over, but they are clearly moving away. You are in the act of deserting. And you're deserting him who called you. This is what really upsets Paul. Like the Israelites, the Galatians were turning their backs on God, who was their provider and their rescuer. Commentator named Longnecker says, this is a shocking state of affairs. It's shocking that the Israelites would turn their back on the God who was providing and caring for them. And it's shocking that people who started out saying they believe the gospel would then turn away from their source of salvation. Again, the Israelites, Judges 2. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals, and they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt. When we talk about the gospel and false gospels, we need to not somehow make this a theoretical concept. We're talking about a relationship with God. So to walk away from the gospel is to walk away from God. That's why it matters that we rehearse the gospel with one another, and that's why we should be warned against false versions of the gospel, because if we buy into any kind of false gospel, we buy into a false God that goes together. We're not going to cover them, because we can't cover every cult and false religion. But when I got to Kingsburg, the town where I was before here, I became exposed to this cult that really had become big in the Central Valley called The Remnant. Maybe some of you have heard of The Remnant. I had never heard of it until we came to Kingsburg. And actually a bunch of people in the area, their families had been sucked into it. And there was this woman who established her false religion. It started as a biblical weight loss was the idea. And then it was, we're going to have Bible studies. And one thing led to another. Pretty soon, she decides they're going to go to Tennessee. They're going to set up a whole compound. She's going to be the sole leader. Everyone's going to do what she says. She knows what's true. Everyone else is a false church. And yet all these people, and I remember getting to Kingsburg, and there were still families that were shocked that their family members bought into this, moved to Tennessee, left the area, and were buying into this cult. And everything that was everything that you think of in a cult in terms of domination, financial control, personal control, sexual ridiculousness, all that was wrapped up in that whole thing. All right. And we go well, that would never happen. And I just remember talking with people that were like, I can't believe that my family member who I love and care for, who used to live right here, who went to the same church as we went to, is now a part of this cult. It is a real deal that when you walk away from the gospel, you adopt a different God. We have to remember that our love for the gospel is not a love for an idea, but a love for a person. And this person called us in the grace of Christ. Paul uses this called at least four other times in Galatians. He uses it as shorthand for coming to salvation. He uses another of his writings too, 1 Corinthians 1:9. God is faithful by whom you were called into the fellowship of his Son. 1 Thessalonians 2:9. We exhort each one of you and encourage you and charge you to walk in a manner worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. God has not called us for impurity, but in holiness. 1 Thessalonians 4:7. 1 Thessalonians 5:23. Now may the God of peace himself sanctify you completely, and may your whole spirit and soul and body be kept blameless at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. He who calls you is faithful. He will surely do it. Peter would use some of the same language. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. And what Paul says is, if you walk away from the gospel, you're walking away from him who called you in the grace of Christ. Grace is how the Galatians came to God, and so it's even more horrific that they would turn their back on God's grace, as it would be for us. Salvation comes through grace. They didn't deserve to come to him, and we haven't deserved to come to him, and now they're abandoning God's grace in favor of some kind of works-based religion. It's really at the bottom of almost of every distinct false gospel is some amount of works religion that turns its back on salvation by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. It proclaims some kind of work. If you walk away from the true gospel, you walk away from God. But Paul says, there is no other good news. Verse number 7, he says, I'm shocked, I'm astonished, you're so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ, you're turning to a different gospel. Not that there is another one, he says. It's not that there is another, there is no other good news. Other translations handle this, I think, in helpful ways. The King James Version says, unto another gospel, which is not another. The New American Standard, for a different gospel, which is really not another. The NIV are turning to a different gospel, which is really no gospel at all. There is no other good news. In the Greek, there are two different words for different. One of them means another, like there's an additional, and that's not what Paul uses here. There is another word that is another of a completely different kind. He's not saying there's a different gospel as in there's another one, additional one. He's saying there it is a different as in it is a whole different kind. So for instance, if you have a chocolate chip cookie and there are no chocolate chips in your chocolate chip cookie, you no longer have a chocolate chip cookie. It is another cookie, and it is another of a different kind. And despite the fact that I have enjoyed a little more variety in my cookie diet over Christmas, I've had some of those, like the cookies that have the Hershey Kiss in them. I think that's a good addition around Christmas time. I've had some chocolate crinkles, that's good. I've had some snickerdoodles. But typically I would say the gospel of cookies is chocolate chip, right? Like thou shalt have no other cookie is I think somewhere in 1 Hezekiah, right? Chocolate chip cookies are the cookie. They're the ultimate cookie. Right, there is no better cookie, right? But if you have a chocolate chip cookie with no chocolate chips, you have a different cookie. It's not a chocolate chip cookie. And Paul's saying there, it's not like there is another gospel. This is totally different. There's no other good news. Acts 4:10, let it be known to all of you and to all the people of Israel that by the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom you crucified, whom God raised from the dead, by him this man is standing before you well. This Jesus is the stone that was rejected by you, the builders, which has become the cornerstone. And there is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. There is no other gospel outside of Jesus, Paul says. But there are people who preach a distorted gospel. He continues, verse number 7. Not that there is another one, but there are some who trouble you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. There are some people who preach a distorted gospel, and that's why we need to have a class on counterfeit gospels, because there are people who want to preach a distorted gospel. He says some, so this is not an isolated problem. It's not just one person. There's a whole group. The some is plural. There's a whole group of people that are preaching a distorted gospel. And they're here right now. And Paul's issuing this warning when he says, there is no other gospel, but there are some who trouble you. And he's saying, they're here right now. Remember that, like, the old Little Red Riding Hood, you know, and she finally, like, gets to the hut, and she says, and there's Granny, who's the big bad wolf, you know. Granny, what large eyes you have. Oh, Granny, what large paws you have. Oh, Granny, what big bad teeth you have. And then the wolf gobbles her down. At least I think in the original, Little Red Riding Hood gets eaten, right? But Paul's saying there are some who trouble you, and they're here right now. Like, what large teeth they have. They want to eat you. We need to be warned about those who would preach a distorted gospel, and they're here. He says there are some who trouble you. That was used in like secular society to describe political agitators who cause confusion and turmoil. This would be like the rioters. They are those who trouble you, right? What he's saying is these false teachers, they're presenting a different gospel. They're like a BLM movement or something like that. They're agitators. They're causing conflict. There's riots happening on the streets. Yeah, that's what he's saying is happening religiously. There are some who trouble you. And John Stott says this, I think, helpfully. To tamper with the gospel is to trouble the church. Indeed, the church's greatest troublemakers, now as then, are not those outside who oppose, ridicule, and persecute it, but those inside who try to change the gospel. Conversely, the only way to be a good churchman is to be a good gospel man. The best way to serve the church is to believe and to preach the gospel. When we talk about these counterfeit gospels, we're not talking about pagan movements. We're talking about spiritual religious movements. We're talking about those that claim some kind of spirituality. And that's where the counterfeit comes in. And they trouble you, he says, some. And we need to know that there are those who preach a distorted gospel. This word distort, Peter quotes Joel 2 in his Pentecost sermon in Acts 2, and he uses this word to describe the sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood. It will be distorted, it'll be altered, it'll be changed. And what's changed is, he says, the gospel of Christ. Christ is who the gospel is about. He's also where it comes from. He's the source of it, and he's the subject of it, and there are people who want to distort the gospel about him. So we have to be aware of that. We have to be cognizant. We have to be on guard. We have to talk about it. So as we talk about these different counterfeit gospels, it's not because we are mean-spirited about our Jehovah's Witness neighbors or because we hate Muslims. There are people who are actively distorting the gospel of Jesus Christ, and there needs to be a warning. There needs to be clarity that is in our minds and in our ability to even defend the true gospel. Because no one has a right to preach a different gospel. Nobody. This is a universal truth. Nobody has a right to preach a different gospel. Paul says, even if we, verse number 8, or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one we preached to you, let him be accursed. No one has a right to say whatever they want about Jesus. He says, but even if, he uses this really strong language, even in the most extreme case, a different gospel is worthy of judgment. If someone comes claiming higher credentials or a more impressive authority than the apostolic gospel, they are accursed. I don't care if it's Joseph Smith and golden plates. I don't care if people that have had visions and dreams, new revelation. No one gets to preach a different gospel. If we or even an angel from heaven should preach to a gospel contrary to the one we preach to you, let him be accursed. Anyone who preaches a different gospel is accursed. And this is, again, really strong language. Paul has been using some potent language just in these verses. This word accursed, could also say anathema, has the idea of given over to be destroyed, devoted to God, devoted to destruction. And the Old Testament is referred to as the ban. So think about Achan and his family and all their possessions that were devoted to destruction, because that's this word, accursed, anathema. Think about the cities in the Promised Land that were accursed. The cities in the Promised Land that were accursed were completely destroyed, that all the way down to the foundations, they're wrecked. That's this word, accursed. Other translations translate this word eternally condemned or damned. He says, anyone who preaches a different gospel is accursed. Here's our final reason from Galatians that we should care about counterfeit gospels. Anyone who preaches a different gospel is accursed. You go, you just said that. Well, I'm just saying what Paul said, and he said it twice, so I'm going to say it twice too. As we have said before, verse 9, so now I say again, if anyone is preaching you a gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed. Obviously, Paul did not forget that he had just written verse 8, and I did not forget that I just commented on verse number 8. The point is, we need to hear it again. If anyone preaches a different gospel, they are damned. They are anathema, which is what we have to say about those who are actively preaching a distorted gospel. The teachers of these false religions stand before God as ones who are accursed, who are damned. And that needs to be the strength of our perspective as well. Now, don't forget that Galatians 3 is coming, and even though we don't have time to get there today, Galatians 3 will tell us that you can either bear the curse of God or you can have Jesus bear the curse for you. Every one of us is born under the rightful curse of God. Every one of us are born anathema, accursed, damned. Left to ourselves, every one of us would follow a different gospel. We'd rely on the works of the law, whether God's law or the one we make up. We would be rightfully cursed. And Paul is explicitly clear, to reject the true gospel of Jesus is to be cursed by God and suffer his judging wrath. And that's why it matters that we consider counterfeit gospels. Secondly, though, that was all reason number one, is an argument from Galatians 1. Secondly, and we'll move quicker through these, the mission of Satan. The mission of Satan is a reason for us to care about counterfeit gospels. In 2 Corinthians 4, we read in verse number 3 that the mission of Satan is to keep unbelievers in the dark. This is what he wants. Even if our gospel is veiled, Paul wrote, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For we proclaim as not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So Satan's mission is to blind. The gospel brings light. But why we have to care about counterfeit gospels is one of the ways that Satan blinds people is not through, again, mere paganism or rampant immorality, although he uses that, but Satan uses religion to blind people's minds. He wants to keep them in the dark, which means we need to shine the light of the gospel on the dark places of Roman Catholicism and on Islam and these other things we're going to talk about. The gospel needs to shine on these dark places. The mission of Satan also includes pulling potential believers into false doctrine, 1 Timothy 4:1. Now the Spirit expressly says that in later times some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and teachings of demons. There are those who will leave, who will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and teaching of demons. Now, we talk about these different false religions, again, within the comparison, because we live in a very politically correct and sensitive age, people say, well, that's not very nice to say that that's a false gospel, or even to say that's a cult, that's kind of rude. Right? It's kind of insensitive to say that your neighbor, who is actually a wonderful person, who is a practicing Mormon and has a wonderful family, and they do all of these very moral and upstanding things, and you just said that they have a false gospel. That's kind of insensitive. Right? Well, the text says that what they follow is the teaching of demons. So if you think it's insensitive to say it's a cult or a false religion, I think it's a little more. We haven't gone far enough if we're going to go as far as the text does. Because the text says that what they're following, what they're getting is a deceitful spirit and a teaching of demons. That's what it is. And we need to be that clear. There is a deceit that comes with religiosity. There's the mission of Satan, but the deceit of religiosity. Here's Matthew 7:15. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. The text tells us, beware, pay attention. Right? So even if you are not enticed to follow some kind of new age spirituality, you'd at least need to beware that there are these kinds of things. There are false prophets. And we have to get that on our radar, that not everybody is telling us the truth. Not all religion is good religion. Just because it's on the religious TV station, is there still religious TV stations? Is that still a thing? Was it TBN? Was that the big famous one? Just because it's on TBN or it's on, Christian radio, and I was listening to this preacher on Christian radio, there's false prophets out there. They're on the airwaves. They're on your TV. They're writing articles. They're writing books. They're on YouTube, right? There's false prophets. You need to be aware of that. They come in sheep's clothing, but inside they're ravenous wolves. You'll recognize them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. You will recognize them by their fruits. There is a deceit to religiosity. Even think about Paul's admonition that in these last days, people will heap to themselves teachers having itching ears. Notice it doesn't say they're not going to listen to teaching. They're just going to prefer teachers that tell them what they want to hear. Right? There's the deceit of religiosity. It's not a refusal to hear. It's just getting people to tell you things that you want to hear. Not everyone who says, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. People can have a religious desire. They will desire to have, it says, itching ears. They will accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own passions. It's not they don't have a desire for teaching. They have a religious desire, and it's deadly for them. Fourth reason for us to care about counterfeit gospels is the need to be Christ-like followers. It matters that we be able to obey the Great Commission when it comes to baptizing people and teaching them to obey everything that Jesus has commanded. If we're going to follow the Great Commission, we have to know the difference between a false gospel and true gospel. We need to know how to answer Colossians 4, 5, and 6. Walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. So we may not be able to answer everything that you would need to know, but I would love by the end of this class that you are more confident when you open the door to that knock. And those two people that are standing there, one of them is wearing a long skirt, and the other one is holding a pamphlet for you and says, "Hi, we'd like to talk to you." And instead of you going, "Oh, we should have ducked. I should have looked through the people first." When you look out and you see two bicycles parked at the end of your driveway, and there's a guy with a placard on his very nice, you know, button-up shirt, and he says, "I'd like to talk to you about my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and I'd love for you to be able to go, let's go, like game on, right? Because I know how to walk toward with wisdom towards outsiders. I can engage with your false religion of Mormonism. I can dismantle your false witness about Jehovah. And I'd love for this class to help you towards that end, whether it is telling you something new or just reconfirming things you already knew. We need to be Christ-like followers. The final reason for us to care about counterfeit gospels is the glory of the gospel. So my grandfather, one of the jobs that he had during his life was being a bank teller. And I still remember him telling me as his grandson about his time when he was getting trained to be a bank teller, and he was being trained to recognize counterfeits. And of course, this is back in the day when they didn't have the brand new designed bill. They didn't have all these things. You know, now, like, you can even go to somewhere as simple as like the dollar store, and if you try to give them a large bill, they'll have like a little pen, and they'll like write on that in it. I don't know, it's supposed to change colors or not change colors or whatever happens, right? So now they have these tools. They didn't have that kind of stuff back then with my granddad. And he said, "You know how they taught me to tell difference between the counterfeit and the real? They didn't give us counterfeits. They just gave us the real. And we had to touch the real, feel the real, smell the real. We had to handle the real over and over and over again. So as soon as somebody put a counterfeit in our hands, we went, that's not real." Why? Because they were so familiar with the real. What I'm saying is the glory of the gospel is when we think about what the real gospel is, it outstrips, it outshines, it shows the counterfeit for the yuck that it is. And we go, no, I love the true gospel. The true gospel of Jesus Christ is wonderful. And as soon as I value the glory of the gospel, then all the rest of these false gospels, like, really, you're going to ask me to do these seven different sacraments, and that's how I'm getting rid of my sin? That's not glorious news. That's awful news that I have to perform and do all these things. I'm going to have to spend how long in purgatory before I pay off my sins? That's not good news for anybody, right? Because I know the true gospel, and it's so beautiful and wonderful. I love the glory of the gospel. All right, so those are reasons for us to care about counterfeit gospels. You may have your own reasons for being here this morning, what you want out of this class, but I hope these are things that encourage your heart and what are we aiming for in this class. Last thing I want to talk about is how we're going to do it. And essentially, in each one of these classes, we want to hit three main areas. We can't say everything there is to say, obviously, about all these different cults and false religions. But we're going to try to make three points over and over again when it comes to cults and false religion. Number one, we're going to talk about different sources of authority. In every cult or false religion, there's a different source of authority than the Bible. So we have to talk about that with every single one of these. Number two, in every single counterfeit gospel, there is a false Jesus. There's a distorted Jesus. There's a non-biblical view of Jesus. So we're going to have to talk about a different source of authority. We're going to talk about a different Jesus. And finally, in each one of these, we're going to talk about a different way of salvation. In each one of these false gospels, you're not just going to be given a different authority and a different Jesus, but a different way to get to heaven. So it matters that we inspect, how do these different cults, how do they say, these false gospels, how do they say we get to heaven? How does that happen? And how does that disagree with the true gospel? So we'll talk about other things as well, history of some of these false gospels, history of some of these cults, key leaders, those kinds of things. But these three points you're going to keep hearing week after week, and hopefully that will help you as you try to pare down, like, okay, I can't cover everything, even with the person at my doorstep or with my high school friend. I can't cover everything. Well, you can cover three things. What's your source of authority? Who's Jesus? And what's the way of salvation? Because those three things are at the heart of distorted gospels, false gospels, as well as at the heart of the true gospel. Okay? All right, realize today was not like super, maybe you don't have a ton of questions, but maybe you do. So questions you want to ask as we kind of kick off this class, maybe things you're interested in hearing about, or so questions you have for me as we finish up class today. Anything? Could be something you're hoping for. Maybe I already said something that was, you want to question more? Yes, Brianna.
I was trying not to raise.
No, we're happy with raising hands. Yeah.
And the Galatians, because I didn't realize that it was written so close to the time that they had been evangelized, do you think that there's a particular danger to new believers being deceived by false gospels?
Absolutely. So I think that is a great immediate application. So people that are fresh in belief or fresh to the church are in a significant place of danger. Which is not to say that any of us should just rest on our laurels and say, I've been a Christian long enough that I would never be deceived by something. But I think there are some people that are new believers in terms of time, and there are some people that are new believers in terms of development. Like, they've been a Christian for 10 years, but maybe they haven't been in their Bible, they haven't been listening to good preaching, and in effect, they still are a new believer. Only they don't feel like it because they've been a Christian for so long, but developmentally they're still just a babe, and they are in significant danger. Yes, I think that's a fair application to make. You think about, maybe to even just use the illustration, you think about my granddad, like when you haven't been enjoying the real gospel and celebrating it and recognizing it and living in it, it makes you more susceptible to believe something that takes that gospel and twists it.
Okay, so I have another question.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm thinking of like kids because they're new believers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in training them to handle real money.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope that we say enough in Sunday school and from the pulpit of talking about being gospel-centered, that that's not just a fad or just a thing we say. I think especially when we think about our kids, for us to assume the gospel for them is such a major parenting mistake for us to make as gospel-believing parents ourselves. Like, we cannot just assume that our children are using the same, or do they mean the same thing when they say faith, when they say Jesus? I mean, Roman Catholicism talks about Jesus, Mormonism talks about Jesus, but we're talking a very different Jesus. Do our kids, when they say Jesus, what are they actually believing and thinking? But because they're our kids, a lot of times we just give like a pass that we wouldn't give to our Mormon neighbor. We know you believe in a false Jesus, right? But we just like give our kids a pass. So how are we reiterating, repeating, and deepening their understanding of who is Jesus? What do we mean by the gospel? What about his life and his death? What is your understanding of substitution? What is your understanding of resurrection? Like, these like crucial gospel facts we just need to be repeating, reiterating. And then as our kids are developing, and this is the really, I think, hard thing about being a Christian parent with kids that you've been preaching the gospel to, they're going through childhood development, which now means they're able to think more, understand more, come to some of their own convictions. They're no longer just parrots. Right? When your kids are little, they'll parrot. You can tell them whatever you want to tell them and they'll repeat it. But once they move into that kind of 10, 11, 12, 13, they're starting to think for themselves. 14, 15, 16, they're really owning it or not owning it. And maybe they're telling you and maybe they're not telling you because they want to please mom and dad. So they don't want to admit that they have any element of disbelief. So now they're fragile, but maybe we haven't given them permission to even say, like, I'm not sure I agree with you, mom and dad, about what is most essential to the gospel. So there's lots of layers to it, but we also have to wisely go through the childhood development process. So it's not just repeat the gospel when they're young, but are we walking with our kids as they develop and how they think about the gospel and what they're able to process and then what they become convinced of themselves. So I don't know. I do think we should think more in terms, as Christian parents, of the development side of our kids maturing mentally and theologically. So I don't know if that's, helpful, but we should continue to deepen, as our kids grow in maturity, we should continue to deepen their experience and expression of the gospel. And how to do that is hard, but.
Don't you think it also just goes back to they mimic us. And so, you know, they're going to realize how you have fallen in love with the gospel and what Christ has done for us.
Yep.
That sometimes, if that's not a counterfeit, they recognize that.
Yep. And so, I think that's a good word.
Which is difficult.
Yeah. So I certainly would not want to, we can't save our kids. Right? We can't make our kids choose what is right. Like, so I definitely want to avoid that. There's no parent that should feel the guilt of like, well, my child didn't come out believing and that's my fault. Every parent will feel elements of like, I could have done better or whatever. So what I'm about to say, that's my caveat of no parent can force their child to become a Christian. And so I wouldn't want parents to feel unnecessarily guilt, but I am concerned that if parents have a trite understanding of the gospel or a superficial relationship with Christ, they're not going to be able to call their kids to something deeper and higher either. So maybe I just said two things out of the same side of my mouth, but parents can't save a kid. But if parents don't have a deep abiding love for Christ and appreciation for the gospel, then why would we think our kids would then get it? Like how else are they going to get it? So, yeah. And a parent who loves the gospel, who loves Christ dearly, that does not guarantee that their child is also going to love Christ. So I'm not saying, don't hear me say both things. I'm not saying, yeah, parents, as long as you love the gospel and you love Christ, then it's your kids will. And, you know, the only reason they won't is if you fail. That's not the gospel, right? So now we're back to false parenting gospels, right? The good news is Jesus saves. Parents don't save. So the good news is the gospel is powerful. The word of Christ creates faith. Right? So faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of Christ. So let's lean into the gospel for everyone, whether it's our kids or our neighbors or our coworker. So I saw a hand or a, yes, Joyce. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
They can follow everything we do, work at church or whatever we do, but they can't mimic our hearts.
Yep. Yep. And we're going to see this in counterfeit gospels. These counterfeit gospels are going to try to accomplish external things that the reality is only God can change the heart. And a counterfeit gospel is going to try to do something to you on the outside, make you look a certain way, do a certain thing. And all of that is going to stop at the superficial. So as Christian parents, we certainly should not stop at the superficial, because we have actually a true gospel that penetrates all the way to the heart. And it's not just about do these religious things, follow this teaching, wear this particular holy underwear, you know what I mean, whatever. Like, we actually have a true gospel, so. Okay? Okay, that's going to finish us up for today. We'll see you in the worship service. Thanks for being here for our intro. We'll see you next week, Lord willing, for